From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Air Talk on 89.3 KBCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today. Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election was sweeping and systematic. It's been 24 hours since the Mueller report was released. We're over the quick takes and ready to dig in. What did the special counsel find and what's being done to prevent another attack? It's all coming up on Air Talk. Stay with us. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KBCC. I'm Libby Denkman. In today, well, Larry Mantle takes some time with his family, and we wish him very good luck on his days off. After 22 months of tracking down witnesses, reading text messages and emails, good old-fashioned detective work, probably a lot more sophisticated methods that we will never know about, Robert Mueller and his team reported extensive Kremlin meddling in the 2016 election and also established the Trump campaign's willingness to accept help from Russia. Even for folks who are steeped in this stuff, full-time news people or politicos, it's been hard to digest this massive amount of information that came out in the Mueller report. So we want to take a few minutes to walk through what the report said and its implications for our democracy, especially election security. Joining me now is Rosalind Helderman, investigative political reporter for The Washington Post and author of the Post's forthcoming book, The Mueller Report. Rosalind, great title, gets right to the point. Welcome to Air Talk.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
You know, I'm kind of breaking this down into two parts because that's the way that Robert Mueller did in his 448-page manifesto, as it were, that came out yesterday. We know that based on part one, the section dealing with Russian interference and collusion, that Russian agents engaged in this massive social media campaign and hacking activities, and that activity favored candidate Donald Trump. Talk to me about what Robert Mueller found and his team found, and if there were any new revelations in that part of the report, part one.
So they sort of identified these two main sort of arms of the Russian operation during the campaign. One was operated directly by the Russian government, which was to hack the emails of Democratic Party people and the party itself, and then to disseminate those emails via their own proxies and also WikiLeaks. And the other was this quasi-governmental effort through this company in St. Petersburg, the Internet Research Agency, to influence American opinion through actual fake news and disinformation and social media accounts posing as Americans but who were actually Russians. And then we get this really interesting and lengthy narrative where they sort of explored whether there was another operation via contacts with the Trump campaign. And they conclude that they can't sort of assess that there was an active conspiracy, nor do they find that any particular person associated with the Trump campaign entered into a criminal conspiracy with the Russians to affect the election. But they do have this incredible narrative of this just sort of flood over many, many, many months of attempts to make contact with the Trump campaign by various Russian government and business leaders, some of which we knew about before, but some of which were brand new.
Yeah, and I'm curious because I think a lot of people hear the word collusion thrown around a lot relating to the Mueller investigation. Obviously, the president uses that word a lot, other people in the media and on the right and the left. But in fact, Mueller himself was not looking for collusion. What was he looking for? And what was the bar to prove that wrongdoing?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it's interesting because the attorney general at his press conference yesterday morning before the release of the report chose to use that collusion language and sort of echo the president, who obviously uses that term a great deal. But the report itself says that that was not an analysis they undertook. They did acknowledge that the Justice Department has used that phrase from time to time, but they found that that is not a legal term of art, and so they would do no analysis of of collusion.
And yeah, I mean, after all that, collusion doesn't really mean anything.
It's meaningless. So what they looked for was conspiracy and also coordination, which turns out to also not be a legal term, but was a term that was used in the mandate appointing them. So I think they tried to sort of give it a legal meaning. And basically what they were looking for was an agreement, an actual agreement, either tacit or express, between someone associated with the campaign and someone associated with the Russian effort to interfere, to work together to do something illegal. And what they noted was to be a conspiracy, it has to be more than two different people working independently and understanding that what each was doing would benefit the other. I don't have that language directly in front of me. I've got it a little wrong. But it's got to be more than just, understanding that someone else is helping. It has to be an actual agreement to assist them with what they're working on.
Because the Trump campaign exhibited a lot of willingness to accept Russian help. I mean, the June Trump Tower meeting is one example, but there were several contacts between Trump associates and WikiLeaks on the leaked John Podesta emails, all sorts of ways that the Trump campaign seemed very willing to say, okay, Russia appears that they want to boost candidate Trump, and we will accept those bits of help. But that didn't rise to the level of a criminal conspiracy, according to Mueller.
Yeah, that's right. And it's interesting. These contacts, they happen at the very highest levels of the campaign with people like Paul Manafort, and they happen with kind of low-level people who are on the fringes. They talk about George Papadopoulos, who people will remember pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI. People know well sort of the episode where he is told in advance that the Russians have dirt about Clinton in the form of emails. But there was a new episode that we didn't know about where he was told by a Russian businessman he was offered in an email disruptive technology to assist the campaign. I don't know what that means. It sure sounds intriguing. And he apparently told the prosecutors that he had no memory of that. And in each of these instances, while they often didn't really go anywhere, you don't see a lot of examples of the Trump campaign saying, no, this feels wrong. This feels inappropriate. We're going to reject this because,
or we should take this to the FBI.
Or even more, we should take this to the FBI.
Moving on to the second part, there's just so much to parse, so many alleys to go down in terms of the information contained in the Mueller report. But I think the big question addressed in part two is a major one, and that's obstruction of justice and whether the president was actively and criminally trying to interfere with the investigation. What did Mueller find when it comes to obstruction, and what was his legal reasoning for coming up with that answer?
Yeah, I mean, this is really interesting. So we have been told by the attorney general that there was something kind of that we didn't fully understand, that he hadn't come to a traditional prosecutorial decision, but he had also failed to exonerate the president. So we now understand that much better. Apparently, what he determined was there is this Justice Department guidance that says that a sitting president cannot be indicted, can't be charged with a crime under the Constitution. So he chose to interpret that even more broadly and to say, look, if I can't charge him with a crime, it is not appropriate, it is not fair, it is not correct for me to assess that he has committed a crime that I cannot thereafter charge him with. And so basically, he set out from the start with the assumption that at the end of the day, he would not be making a charging decision.
And part of that was because the president can't defend himself. The president would never appear in court because the prosecution can't happen. And so if Mueller came down and said this was criminal obstruction, it would be a charge that the president had no way to refute. That was contained in the report, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. That in our legal system, charges then lead to trials, and that's how people defend themselves and potentially convince a jury of their peers that it hasn't been proven against them. So he had made this decision that he would not be he wouldn't be coming to a decision, was a crime committed or was a crime not committed. So instead, what he did was a very thorough factual analysis of what happened. And that factual analysis is really quite damning.
Attorney General Bill Barr did come to a conclusion in the four-page summary he released a few weeks ago and also in his press conference that he predicated the report with. And he said that, you know, both the president was cleared of and his team was cleared of any criminal conspiracy with the Russians, but also that Barr was coming to a conclusion on obstruction and that he was not guilty of any criminal obstruction. But the reasoning that Barr brought to the fore in his summary seem for Mueller to not make a conclusion on obstruction seems very different than what Mueller actually laid out in the report that you so eloquently just described. Are folks zeroing in on that gap between what the attorney general presented as Mueller's findings and what Mueller actually described in his report?
Yes, absolutely. And that's an area of very vigorous reporting for us right now. We're trying to understand that better. The attorney general did say at his press conference that he disagreed with some of the special counsel's legal analysis around obstruction. And I think we didn't fully understand that at the time. It seems like one piece of what he might be disagreeing with, although, as I said, we're still trying to get to the bottom of this. But was that question of whether or not this Justice Department guidance should be interpreted to say that you can't even come to a conclusion about whether charges should be filed. That was sort of the going framework of the Mueller investigation, and it seems as though Barr doesn't agree with it. It feels as though you can decide he should or shouldn't be charged, and just simply not file the charges if you think he should be. But interestingly, Barr also indicated that this guidance was not a part of Mueller's decision not to come to a conclusion, and that doesn't seem to be correct at all. And so we are trying to understand better, was he just not being honest? Is there a nuance that we're not fully understanding? It is our understanding that something of what he described of a meeting that he had with Bob Mueller in early March, of what Mueller said about the guidance, about this Department of Justice guidance, might be accurate. So that's just something we don't quite understand yet, and we're working on.
So maybe a conversation that was had between the two men then was translated into a summary that just simply doesn't seem to be reflected in the actual report. Rosalind, we are running a little short on time, but anything else that you are trying to fill in terms of your reporting right now? Rosalind Helderman with The Washington Post is on with me now, and her forthcoming book is called The Mueller Report. She's the author of The Post's forthcoming book. What else are you trying to fill in at this point, and where is your reporting leading you?
Well, I mean, I just think, you know, on the question we were just discussing, we should be hearing from Bob Mueller before too terribly long. The Hill has made very clear, Capitol Hill, that they're going to be requesting his testimony. And so hopefully, actually, for the first time in 2 years, hearing directly from him will help shed some light on those questions.
Rosalind Helderman with The Washington Post, thank you so much for joining me on Air Talk today.
Thank you for having me.
And coming up next, how are congressional Democrats handling the release of the redacted report and what is next for their investigations? We are going to hear directly from the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. Representative Adam Schiff is in studio with me next. Stick around. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KBCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today. Well, after almost 2 years, 34 indictments, a huge amount of information uncovered about Russian attacks, confirmation of the president's attempts to interfere with the special counsel's investigation, 7 guilty pleas, and 4 people in Trump's orbit sentenced to prison time, Republicans are still celebrating the release of the redacted Mueller report, saying it clears the president of criminal collusion and obstruction. How will congressional Democrats respond? My next guest is at the tip of the spear. Congressman Adam Schiff, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, joins me now. Welcome, sir. Thanks for being in studio on Air Talk.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
So you represent the 28th district right here in Southern California, including parts of Burbank, Glendale, Echo Park, Hollywood, and Pasadena. You've been on the front lines of congressional investigations into the Trump campaign and the president's associates, Russian interference, all of it. So take me back just a few weeks ago, this summary of the attorney general's Barr report, the summary that has kind of been known as the Barr report released last month. It said that there was no collusion and, according to Barr, no obstruction by President Trump. Of course, the full Mueller report with some redactions paints a much more nuanced picture. What has changed in your mind after reading and absorbing this entire redacted report?
Well, I would say, first of all, that the attorney general's characterization wasn't a matter of nuance. It was intended and was directly misleading of the American people. On both the obstruction and the issue of collusion or conspiracy, on obstruction of justice, the attorney general presented the American people that Mueller was unable to reach a conclusion. And as he suggested in his press conference, this was not because the Department of Justice had a policy against indicting a sitting president, but merely because the questions of law and fact were too difficult. That proved not to be true. In fact, Mueller was relying very heavily on the injunction that he could not indict a sitting president. And Mueller, in fact, found substantial evidence that could be used to charge the president were that policy not in place. On the issue of conspiracy, while it is true that the special counsel didn't find that he could prove the elements of the crime of conspiracy, Mueller made it very clear he did not analyze the question of collusion. That is what most Americans think of as a corrupt getting together, a combining of efforts. And in fact, that was a distinction that I've been making for the last 2 years, which the attorney general, because he wanted to use the president's talking points, I think, misled the country about. And that was part of the White House's communication strategy. But that's not the attorney general's job. He's not the Sarah Huckabee Sanders of the Justice Department or the Kellyanne Conway. He is supposed to be the representative of the American people, but he's acting more like Rudy Giuliani. And that, I think, was a grave disservice. But now we have the actual facts. And the facts, I think, paint a very damning picture of a president who would repeatedly lie to the American people, who would urge others to lie to the American people, people who came before our committee and others and lied to us, as well as a president who sought to obstruct an investigation in which he was implicated, and a campaign that was all too willing to have the help of a foreign adversary. Indeed, Mueller found built its entire communication strategy around that help, rather than alerting authorities, rather than rejecting foreign meddling. They welcomed it. Indeed, the president, we learned within hours of the president calling on the Russians to hack Hillary's emails, 5 hours later, the Russians, in fact, for the first time, trying to hack a Clinton email server. So a pretty damning portrait that we now have to absorb.
Republicans arguing, of course, that as Bill Barr said, no collusion, no obstruction. This doesn't move the needle. The report is out now and it's time to move on, really. Kevin McCarthy, the House Minority Leader, said yesterday that nothing we saw in the report changes the underlying result of a 22-month long Mueller investigation that ultimately found no collusion. I know you rightly parse that word collusion and whether or not it has meaning, according to the Mueller report. Is Kevin McCarthy right in saying that it's time to move the needle because people simply have chosen sides on this thing and it's not changing anyone's mind?
You know, I think when this chapter of history is written, some of the most damning language will be reserved for the leadership, the GOP leadership in Congress, people like Kevin McCarthy, who ignored their constitutional duty, who viewed themselves as merely a surrogate for the president. Kevin McCarthy won't even defend the Congress's power of the purse. He will allow the president to eviscerate not just our own institution in Congress, but attack the freedom of the press, attack the independence of the Justice Department. And, you know, honestly, I think that kind of sycophantic behavior is really what has our democracy trembling. It's not just having an unethical president. It's having a leadership in Congress and the GOP that puts party and loyalty to this president above everything else. And we see it in Kevin McCarthy's reaction to this report. Now, we saw it in his comments before the report, so this is nothing new.
But, you know, people like Vice President Mike Pence would charge you with putting party ahead of your duty in Congress. He says that the justice system and that congressional inquiry is being exploited in pursuit of a political agenda. It seems as though that shoe fits on both sides of the aisle, the charges that all of this is motivated by partisan politics.
You know, that's only the case if you fail to distinguish between two arguments. If you say that merely because one side makes a claim and the other side makes the claim that equally both sides are equally right or wrong, that's simply not the case. Mike Pence would have to explain why he believes that a president lying to the American people is okay. He'd have to explain why he thinks the president's actions, which might have been charged but for the fact of a Justice Department policy against charging a sitting president, that conduct, which the special counsel could not rule out being criminal, is okay with the vice president of the United States. Now, Mike Pence is a prime example of a public official unwilling to stand up to this president in any way, shape, or form. His job is to look adoringly at Donald Trump every day of the year. And so I don't think you could take his opinion too far in this respect. Look, the facts speak for themselves. And, you know, what we need to do, I think, in Congress is protect the country from a president without an adequate moral compass. And that means standing up to our adversaries, protecting our elections infrastructure, because the president will not. But it also means holding administration accountable. And that means investigating any allegations of misconduct or corrupt behavior, because we cannot take this president at face value. We cannot assume that he will act within the law or according to ethical standards. And to do otherwise, I think, would be negligent in our responsibilities.
Do you think that the special counsel abdicated his responsibilities by not coming to a conclusion on obstruction?
I don't think so. You know, it's certainly not satisfying to have a two-year investigation and then a report that says he may have committed a crime, the president may have committed a crime, but we don't feel that we can spell that out because of this Department of Justice policy. Now, I have said for some time, I think the Department of Justice policy against indicting a sitting president is misplaced. I agree with the arguments about putting a president through a trial. But the argument that the stigma of an indictment means that we should delay any legal action until the president leaves office, when there is a risk, as there is in this case, that the statute of limitations will run during the presidency and the president will be effectively beyond the reach of the criminal law, something that Mueller said he did not believe the president should be, that to me militates in favor of indictment and postponing the trial. But Mueller concluded otherwise. Frankly, I expected he would conclude otherwise. He is very conservative, not in a left-right way, but he
conservative.
Policy conservative. He would follow the precedent of the Office of Legal Counsel, which is nothing more than one lawyer's written opinion. It's not a court precedent. But that's what I expected that he would do, and that's, in fact, what he did do. I will say this, though, and very much contrary to what Bill Barr has said, he did not expect, I think, from this report that an attorney general who applied for the job by talking down the obstruction case would airdrop himself in between Mueller and the Congress and arrogate to himself.
On that topic, we heard from some members of the media, some members, elected officials, saying that Mueller's team, after the Bill Barr summary was released, were speaking out and saying that they were unhappy with the way the summary framed, especially the obstruction part of the report. Did you hear from Mueller's team at any point in this interim between the summary and the report being released?
I did not, but I think those reports are probably well placed because we now know, which we suspected at the time, Mueller wrote his own summaries. And there was no reason, because those summaries are very lightly, if redacted at all, there's no reason why Barr, if he felt that he needed to put something out before the report was released, could not have used Mueller's own words. But, of course, Barr had a completely different object, and that was to serve the interests of the president. And therefore, he gave us this misleading summary of his own, and then he gave us this misleading press conference. The press conference itself could not have been more graphic proof of Bill Barr's ill motive, because What was to be gained by going out an hour and a half before the report is released to put his spin on it, and an inaccurate spin at that, if not to prejudice the public's view of the damning evidence that was to come? So Bill Barr has deeply deserved the country, but that, frankly, is far less important than the serious allegations of impropriety against the president that are laid out in great detail in that report.
Bob Mueller in the report includes his justification for not coming to a conclusion on obstruction, but he also appears to say that a criminal prosecution is possible after the president leaves office. I quote from the report now, saying the OLC, the Office of Legal Counsel opinion, which is that opinion that he based his obstruction decision on, the OLC opinion also recognizes that a president does not have immunity after he leaves office. Do you think that Robert Mueller was suggesting that there is a possibility for prosecution of President Trump or other members of his circle after his presidency ends?
I don't think there's any question about that. Mueller makes explicit reference to the need to preserve recollections while they're fresh for a later judicial proceeding. He certainly, I think, also intimates that the Congress could take this up through an impeachment proceeding. But you don't need to preserve recollections for that. So he's talking about something that happens later. And I think what he's referring to is the potential of prosecution later. He distinguishes the objects of a prosecution as being different than the objects of an impeachment. I'll also say this, though, and here's an inconsistency in the Justice Department handling of this. The Southern District of New York mentions in an indictment someone it calls Individual One as directing a criminal campaign fraud scheme.
That's the Michael Cohen stopping the women who had alleged affairs with Donald Trump from speaking.
Exactly. The hush money payment scheme that was violative of our campaign finance laws because it amounted to campaign contributions far in excess of the limits and corporate contributions that are not permitted at all. That indictment says that Individual One directed and coordinated this illegal scheme. Well, we know that Individual One is the president of the United States. So the Justice Department there felt that the stigma of basically naming the president as an unindicted co-conspirator did not outweigh the interest of justice in identifying a party responsible for criminal conduct. And I think that decision was the right decision. But I also think that it's clear that what Mueller was alluding to, that there's both a congressional remedy potentially, but there's also the need to preserve this evidence for a potential criminal prosecution after the presidency.
You have, in the last 24 hours, backed away from the idea of an impeachment anytime soon or starting impeachment proceedings. A lot of Democrats, especially on the far left, will say this is a roadmap to impeach this president. What the special counsel has laid out is the map to bringing impeachment charges. What's your response? Does Congress have an oversight role, an oversight responsibility to step in with an impeachment proceeding?
We absolutely have an oversight role here. The question of whether that oversight should be done as part of an impeachment proceeding is something that we're going to have to discuss as a caucus. We've had now about 24 hours to let the import of this report sink in. It's clear that Mueller was suggesting that that is one remedy Congress could take up. It's also clear that the Republicans in Congress, and you quoted from some of the leadership, like people like Kevin McCarthy, are utterly unwilling to do their constitutional duty in holding this president accountable in any way, shape, or form. So it's at this point, it's very unlikely that impeachment could be successful in the Senate. And so we'll have to discuss as a caucus whether we do our oversight as part of an impeachment proceeding or whether we do our oversight as part of our committee jurisdiction, as we have been doing for the last 2 years. And obviously, that's an important and difficult decision. But one way or the other, that oversight is going to get done, and it has to. One of the things that Mueller did not discuss in his report are the counterintelligence findings, which are of key interest and importance to my
committee. And I definitely want to get to the issue of counterintelligence later in our conversation as well, because I think that's a huge issue, of course, for you on the House Intel Committee. Just really quickly back to the issue of impeachment. If Mueller, in his findings on obstruction, lays out the idea that Congress has the ability to step in and provide that oversight, to provide the consequences for an executive who cannot be brought to trial while he's in office, the only way to hold somebody in that highest office accountable, it seems, is an impeachment proceeding, even if it would not be successful. If you believe, as you've laid out here today, that the president engaged in high crimes and misdemeanors that, you know, would be included in an impeachment statute, isn't it your responsibility to go ahead with an impeachment proceeding, despite the fact that there are political realities that would undermine it?
You know, there are certainly many who feel that an impeachment proceeding should be brought regardless of whether it can be successful, that there is a merit to having an impeachment trial, even if it's destined to fail. That is a very substantial judgment to make, because it means that for the next 2 years, the Congress would be tied up in an impeachment proceeding, destined to fail. If we cannot expect that the Republican members would show any dedication to duty or objectively view the president's conduct, then that would be the course that we'd be on, and that's obviously a very weighty decision. It's not a binary choice, though. It's not we either do oversight through an impeachment proceeding or we do nothing. We will be doing oversight regardless of whether it's in the context of an impeachment proceeding. We will be holding the administration accountable. We will be exposing the wrongdoing of the administration regardless of the remedy or the process in which we do it. And so, you know, we are going to caucus on this and discuss what the best way forward is. But we are also mindful of the fact that the country wants us to focus, yes, on oversight, yes, on accountability, but also on making sure that people have good-paying jobs, that they can put bread on the table, that they don't lose their health care, that they're protected from the scourge of gun violence. There are a lot of priorities that my constituents have in addition to holding the administration accountable.
And on that topic, we do have to take a quick break, but we're going to hear from some of your constituents coming up after the news here and about what they think about the priorities of prosecuting an impeachment proceeding or going, you know, balancing that with domestic policy priorities that are important in the district. Congressman Adam Schiff, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, joins me now, and representative represents a lot of our listening audience here on KBCC. I'm Libby Dankman, in for Larry Mantle on Air Talk. We're going to be back after this news break with Hedy Lynn Hurdies.
Done. It's out. I think Schiff ought to accept it.
It's just a waste of time, I think. Let's let it ride.
It's a shame that Trump has taken advantage of every aspect of the government right now.
Those are some 28th District constituents of my guest right now, Congressman Adam Schiff, who represents parts of Burbank, Pasadena, and Glendale. And our reporter went out after Congressman Schiff had a media opportunity in Burbank and kind of talked to some men on the street, you know, get their reaction of the Mueller report just coming out and your priorities in terms of focusing on these investigations versus policies, lawmaking that could affect your constituents in Burbank and around Southern California. What do you think about the charges that maybe focusing so much on oversight of the president is pulling you away from duties for your 28th district constituents?
Look, I think most of the country is very deeply polarized during the Trump presidency. You have a group of people that are devoted to the president, and he can do no wrong. You have a great many Americans, and I think the vast majority of my constituents, who are deeply troubled by the unethical behavior of this president and want him to be held accountable. But I think all my constituents want to make sure that we do both our constitutional oversight responsibility, but we also offer a positive agenda that to meet the needs of everyday Americans who are working harder than ever, having a harder time putting away anything for retirement, still struggling with health care costs, and want us to address those bread and butter issues. And I think we can never lose sight of that. Those are the, I think, most important priorities for my constituents. But we need to be able to do both. If we don't do our oversight work, particularly when we have someone in the Oval Office with no ethical compass, then bad things happen to the country. And so we need to be able to do both.
2020 looming and campaigns, especially for president, but of course, congressional campaigns will be ramping up. In Southern California, we had many seats that narrowly flipped from red to blue in Orange County and North LA County. The issues that we heard out reporting on those elections, a lot of them, you know, focused on child separation or health care, the economy, things like that. Most of the Democrats who won didn't run on the Russia investigation. Is there a danger for Democrats to overweight the investigation and be perceived as taking their eye off the ball?
I think you're absolutely right that the candidates who won in these competitive districts, they campaigned on very much the bread and butter issues I was talking about. And I think that that's why those issues have to be the number one priority. If you look at what Democrats have done since we took over the majority, and it's only been a couple months so far that we've controlled the House, we've passed legislation to protect people's access to health care. We have used that position in the House to fight the president's efforts to do away with health care for people with pre-existing conditions. We fought for better wages. We fought for equal pay for men and women. We've passed gun safety legislation that hasn't passed in decades. We passed bills to outlaw gerrymandering and dark money and to improve our election process and secure our polling places. This is just in the last 2 months. So we are clearly able to put forward a positive agenda even while we do our oversight. And, you know, the reality is that we cannot neglect one for the other. Yes, the oversight work is far more attractive to the eye. It draws the interest of the press. It draws the cameras to the committee rooms. And it's hard for legislation, even when it's very significant, to compete with that, particularly when the Republican Senate kills a lot of this very important legislation. But there is also a risk, as I mentioned before, when you have a president who is urging his staff to engage in illegality, even when that staff refuses, there is a risk of not doing adequate oversight. And, you know, let me give you a perfect illustration. We have seen multiple reports now that the president has sought to intervene with the Justice Department to prevent the merger of the parent of CNN because he hates CNN. We have seen reports that the president has secretly met with the Postmaster General to raise postal rates on Amazon to punish Jeff Bezos and the Washington Post. If these allegations are correct, it means the president is trying to violate the First Amendment, trying to censor the press by using the instruments of state power. I don't think we can ignore that. Because we also have a priority of protecting the country from gun violence. We have to be able to do both.
Just coming back to the report, and I might get a little bit in the weeds on some of these questions, but they really stuck out to me as mysteries in terms of the way that Mueller conducted his investigation and indictments. When it comes to the Trump Tower meeting in June of 2016 between Trump Jr., the son-in-law, Jared Kushner, Paul Manafort, and Russian agents, this was an offer of help for the Trump campaign of dirt on Hillary Clinton. Even if this action did not rise to the level of criminal conspiracy, as Mueller concluded, why was this not prosecuted as a campaign finance violation if there was a significant item of value offered to the campaign by a foreign entity?
Well, that's a great question because it illustrates a lot about the debate we've had over collusion and conspiracy. By any, I think, reasonable person's understanding of the term collusion, if a foreign power offers a presidential campaign help that it describes as part of the Russian government's effort to help that campaign, and the answer from the campaign is, if it's what you say it is, we would love it, and they set up a secret meeting to receive it, and they lie about it, that would meet anyone's definition of collusion. And so for Bill Barr to say no collusion, or the president or his minions or Sarah Huckabee Sanders or Kellyanne Conway to repeat that mantra is simply at odds with the obvious facts. Mueller had to look at a different question, though. Was it a conspiracy to violate the campaign laws to accept foreign help, which is illegal? And while he found, you know, evidence that Trump Jr. and the campaign accepted that offer of Russian help, The reason he couldn't charge that as a crime of conspiracy is the crime of conspiracy required a specific intent, willful intent to violate the law. And Mueller found that he could not sufficiently prove that Don Jr. knew he was breaking the law by doing this, and that the dirt they got on Clinton at that meeting, he couldn't prove necessarily that it was of such value to violate the law.
So there wasn't a way to put a dollar amount on the hacked emails or the information that they were being the emails didn't have to do with the June 2016 meeting. But in general, this acceptance of help from Russia, there wasn't able to be an assessment of the value in order to prove that it was a campaign finance violation.
Well, like much of the Mueller report, the facts seem to suggest that the Trump campaign tried to violate the law. They took this meeting. They lied about this meeting. They hoped to get dirt on Hillary Clinton, and they may very well have believed that what they were going to get were these stolen emails. But what they got instead was information out about the Ziff brothers, something that wasn't that useful. And Don Jr. was very disappointed that the dirt wasn't better. And Jared Kushner and Paul Manafort, who also took the meeting under the expectation of getting dirt on Hillary Clinton, were like, this is not good dirt. We're wasting our time. So they were trying.
Republicans would say, though, also that anyone would take that meeting in a situation where you're in a very, you know, tight campaign and you want to win. They argue it didn't rise to criminal conspiracy, and it's not unusual for people to want some opposition research on their
opponent.
This is
exactly what the Republicans are arguing. And it's exactly what I was talking about in committee the other day when I said that if we get to the point where we think that's okay, then we are in far worse shape as a nation than even I expected. It's not okay to take help from a foreign power. It's not ethical. It's not moral. It's deeply unpatriotic. It may or may not be criminal, but it is all those things. And we cannot adopt the view, because I don't think it's true, and it would be disastrous if we did, that, okay, everybody does it. Everybody doesn't get Russian help in a presidential campaign. John McCain would have never accepted it. Mitt Romney would have never accepted it. Donald Trump and his campaign were willing to accept it. And in fact, we're willing to build a whole campaign messaging strategy around it.
And something that Mueller laid out in his report, we do have to just take a quick break. Congressman Adam Schiff joins me now, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee and representative of the 28th District here in Southern California. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. The tantalizing details and clues that were in the Mueller report having to do with counterintelligence investigations of the Trump campaign and Russian interference, that's coming up next on Air Talk. Stick with us. Thanks for listening to Air Talk. While Larry Mantle is away, I'm Libby Denkman, speaking with Congressman Adam Schiff in studio here at KPCC. And moving on to the counterintelligence part of the Mueller investigation and the wider counterintelligence probes that will continue on after this investigation has wrapped up, as it has. The issue of counterintelligence findings, Congressman Schiff, it's separate from the inquiry into whether the president or his associates criminally conspired with Russia. If I understand correctly, one issue requires a knowing agreement between the parties, a conspiracy. But another area is this more broad look at whether someone could, say, be an unwitting agent or asset of a foreign government. You are in the Gang of Eight, I believe, the group of high-ranking members of Congress who will be briefed on Mueller's counterintelligence findings. Have you any inkling of when that will happen or what will be contained in that briefing?
There's a statutory obligation for the Justice Department and the intelligence community to brief the Intelligence Committee on any significant counterintelligence finding. And you're right, there were two investigations going on, a criminal investigation, which the Mueller report is about, and a counterintelligence investigation that goes to whether people are acting as witting or unwitting agents of a foreign power, whether it is criminal or not. Now, if it's witting, you would expect that it would be criminal, but we don't see those findings in this report. Now, there is some information that goes potentially to both. The effort to build a real estate project in Moscow Trump Tower, during the presidential campaign was deeply compromising of Donald Trump. It was a lifelong ambition to build this tower. It would make him a fortune, potentially hundreds of millions of dollars. He concealed it from the country. He misled the country about it. He sought Kremlin help for it while he was advocating a different policy towards the Kremlin. You can imagine how that would distort U.S. policy if the president is seeking financial gain by his dealing with the Russians. Things along those lines are counterintelligence nightmares, whether it's a crime or not. Now, it's not a crime to have a real estate deal. Is it a crime to lie to the country about it and conceal it? Is it a crime to be motivated to be favorable to Vladimir Putin? Because if Putin comes out against your Trump Tower, it's dead. Well, it may not be a crime, but you can see how it could distort U.S. policy. When this was discovered, that contrary to what Michael Cohen testified to our committee under oath, contrary to what the president was telling the country, that in fact they were pursuing this deal well up through the campaign, up until June at least, when he became the presumptive nominee. When it was discovered a year later, all the deception, and the president was asked about it, his answer was very transparent. It was, that's not a crime, and why should I miss out on all those opportunities? I might have lost the election. That's breathtaking, because what it tells the American people, or it should, is the president may still want to build that tower. It may be his view to this day that I might not get reelected. Why should I miss out on building that Trump Tower? I would be a fool to criticize Vladimir Putin, the person who will make the decision about whether I make all that money. And I don't know that we've ever had a situation where it was so unclear to the people whether the president was acting in their interest or his family's financial interest. But that is a very real problem that we have to deal with.
You are looking into things like the president's finances in terms of conflicts of interest. I know a number of committees have been subpoenaing information from banks like Deutsche Bank that has been willing to do business with President Trump. Where do your independent congressional investigations go next? What are the next areas of inquiry that you're trying to fill in?
Well, our first priority is to get all the counterintelligence information that was gathered by investigators, both on the Mueller team, but also Mueller makes clear that his team included FBI agents who were embedded to focus on the counterintelligence issues.
That new, that there were FBI agents embedded with the Mueller team separately observing and intaking that information and then kind of taking that ongoing information for future investigations? Was that a new piece of information, or did we know that there were FBI agents embedded with the Mueller team?
That was certainly new information for the public. Now, we had some visibility into what Mueller was doing and some inkling about how the counterintelligence investigation may be being handled. But this was the first explicit declaration of what the structure looks like. And Mueller made clear that a part of those findings are not included in his report, which was basically a report about prosecutorial decision making. So our first priority is to get that information, the underlying evidence. And indeed, this is a rare area of bipartisan agreement between Mr. Nunes and myself. We made a joint request for all of that information. And, you know, our committee needs to make sure that the president is not acting in the Russian interest because of money, not acting in the Gulf interest because of money. We need to make sure we protect the country.
I want to close with this. You have plenty of critics, Congressman Schiff. I know it will not surprise you. Some are very vocal on social media. There was an op-ed from Scott Jennings, a conservative commentator in USA Today, that jumped out to me. And he directly was calling for you to resign because of this, the revelations in the Mueller report. He said, quote, "For 2 years, Schiff and other Democrats in Congress repeatedly claimed there was evidence of collusion. Time and again, Schiff said he had, quote, direct evidence of Russian collusion, and he has yet to back down. Politically, Schiff blew up a balloon for the Democrats that Mueller popped loudly." So this balloon metaphor aside, what do you think about the charge that there was an expectation built about the Mueller report that simply it wasn't possible to fulfill by yourself and other members of Congress?
Well, I don't know if this conservative gentleman wrote his op-ed before the Mueller report came out. He, like many people, made the same claim based on Barr's misleading summary. In fact, he ought to read the first 120 pages of the report, which set out chapter and verse unethical conduct in concert with the Russians that we would all consider to be collusion. Now, I have distinguished always dozens and dozens of times over the last 2 years between evidence of unethical conduct that we call collusion and whether Mueller would prove the elements of the criminal conspiracy and said these are not the same thing. Now, he understands that, but he has a political view to carry, and that's the political view of the president. And I think, though, if you read the Mueller report, you see that Mueller distinguishes between collusion and criminal conspiracy, and that's exactly what I've been doing.
Congressman Adam Schiff, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee and representative of the 28th District here in Southern California, thank you so much for joining me on Air Talk.
Thank you.
It's Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today, but John Horn is coming up next with Film Week. Stick with us.
Hello, it's Film Week. I'm John Horn, host of The Frame on KPCC. I am sitting in for Larry Mantle today. We have lots of new releases to cover for you headed into the weekend. Plus, later on the show, we'll discuss about some notable movies that got stuck in the land where time stands still in Hollywood. It's called Development Hell, and we'll talk about some of the movies that escaped and a few of the movies that didn't. But first, reviews. Joining us this week are Justin Chang, film critic for the LA Times, Claudia Puig, the president of the LA Film Critics Association, and our animation guru, Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. He also contributes to the LA Times. Welcome, one and all.
Thank you.
Hi, John.
Hello there. So we're going to start with The Curse of La Llorona. It's a horror film starring Linda Cardellini and Raymond Cruz. People will know him from Breaking Bad. It's written by Miki Daughtry and Tobias Iaconis and directed by Michael Chavez, who makes his feature directing debut. Claudia, I know how much you love to be scared. Were you scared by this movie?
Not enough. You know, this is a very important legend to those of us who are Latinos, and they really kind of rendered it toothless, which is a shame. They turned it into kind of a typical ghost story with all the things that, you know, you expect, tired horror movie tropes, things that go bump in the night. I will say it's a view of Los Angeles I've never seen. It was a very, very dark, stormy view of Los Angeles, which is something it seems like it would have been more befitting someplace in the East Coast. And it was set in 1973. The performances are good, but I just felt like I wanted more about the complexity of the original folk tale of La Llorona. You know, there, Michael Chavez, who you mentioned, the director, has, you know, a fairly deft touch at some of those scares, but I appreciated that Spanish was interwoven into the narrative, and I appreciated that it didn't do things like, hello, abuelita. Grandmother, the way you see, you know, just really nobody talks like that.
So is the legend more interesting than the film? What
is the legend?
The legend
is much more interesting. The legend is about this woman who, it's sort of told slightly differently in different versions, but it's basically this woman who was madly in love with this husband, this nobleman who he married beneath his station, and so he eventually leaves her. She's so upset. She gets revenge by drowning their two sons. And then she immediately feels remorse and she's crying and weeping and tries to get her children back, but it's too late. So the story or the folk legend that Latino parents use to kind of, scare their children straight. Yeah. Is you better behave or La Llorona will come and get you and she'll come and you know, drown you.
And it sounds like the curse just went onto your laptop as you were talking
yes,
about
I
the
apologize
movie.
They have for now that. La Llorona is cursing it.
On your film because you said bad things. The Curse of La Llorona stars Linda Cardellini, Patricia Velasquez, and Raymond Cruz. It's the feature directing debut of Michael Chavez. It's rated R and it is in wide release. Now we're going to talk about the comedic drama, The Man Who Killed Don Quixote. It's directed by Terry Gilliam, who co-wrote the screenplay with Tony Grissoni. Adam Driver and Jonathan Pryce star in the film, inspired by Cervantes' classic tale about a Spanish knight with dreams of grandiosity. Justin, why don't you get us started on Don Quixote?
Yeah, this is the final realization of a movie nearly 30 years in the making,
and unmaking, as it notes cheekily at the outset. This is Gilliam's extraordinarily ill-fated adaptation of the Cervantes novel. It was originally supposed to star Jean Rochefort and Johnny Depp, only to bog down in one epic mishap after another. Sets were destroyed by floods. Rochefort got sick. There were massive financial difficulties.
Johnny Depp got old.
Yes. They had to recast it in the end. There was this great documentary, Lost in La Mancha, made in 2002, which I remember seeing years ago. And now, here it is. And it's a bit of a relief after all that to watch this movie and say, this isn't that bad. It's not that, all things considered, it's not that good either.
You're praising with faint damn.
I can see it on the poster already. It's a bit of a relief, though, because I think it suffers from a lot of the problems that Terry Gilliam movies do, even the ones that do not go so fantastically awry. It seems to be just flailing all over the screen. But there is a fascination, I think, in seeing how this movie more or less found its way, and now it stars Adam Driver, who plays this young director who's shooting a Don Quixote-themed TV commercial. It's very meta, in Spain. And then a decade earlier, he was making this black-and-white arty student film, also of Don Quixote, and the guy who played him, who is played by Jonathan Pryce, has now gone mad. He's this village shoemaker, and he actually thinks he's Don Quixote. So much fitfully amusing, manically choreographed chaos ensues. Stellan Skarsgård and Olga Kurylenko are there. There's a lot of chaos, a lot of destruction. It's a Terry Gilliam movie. But I think that the strength of it is, for all its kind of lack of discipline, his affection for the material comes through. And there's feeling here. There's something personal. And I think this is, the story is one of someone falling under the spell of some grand delusion. And I think that actually is a very nice metaphor for Gilliam's as a filmmaker.
Claudia, what do you think?
I agree, generally. You expect it to be, you think it'll either be a catastrophe or a masterpiece, and it is neither. It's in that vast middle area. It's entertaining, sometimes exhausting, and it's uneven. It's not to the level of Brazil or The Adventures of Baron Munchausen or Fisher King or even 12 Monkeys, but it is... it's fitfully entertaining. I would say Jonathan Pryce is perfect in that role as Don Quixote. And I thought Adam Driver was really good, too. He showed more of his comic skills than we've seen.
But, to jump in, though, I'm not sure Don Quixote is filmable.
No,
Walt Disney tried to film it three times, and the studio tried again after he died. And the novel is so long and episodic and complicated, it just doesn't lend itself to a 2-hour movie.
I did like the locations. I thought they were beautiful in Spain.
That's like singing the scenery, I guess. Does Charles make a good point that maybe the problem in trying to adapt this novel is that it was unadaptable?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that he is kind of maybe the right match for it if it was adaptable, mm-hmm. with his sort of sense of daffiness and goofiness and wittiness. But I think you're probably right.
And Justin, you said the Terry Gilliam movies that didn't go off the rails. is there one? I can't think of one.
Speaking of that, curses are quite the theme this week, I have to say. I saw this movie. It was closing night film of the Cannes Film Festival last year, which is kind of a cursed slot to begin with. A producer sued to attempt to block the screening. The Terry Gilliam had a health scare. Up until the last minute, we were convinced like a meteor was going to strike the theater. So it didn't, but and we saw the movie. So happy ending, I suppose.
Hopefully it doesn't strike today in the theaters. Yeah.
There have been a lot of movies where I wished a meteor had struck the theater before I went in.
Yeah.
The Man Who Killed Don Quixote is directed and co-written by Terry Gilliam, and it stars Adam Driver and Jonathan Pryce. The film is unrated, and you can see it at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset. Now we're going to talk about Penguins. It's a documentary from Disney that features narration by Ed Helms. Alistair Feathergill and Jeff Wilson co-directed the film, which was written by David Fowler. Charles.
Well, this is continuing a genre that Walt Disney actually invented right after World War II, which is you take a nature documentary, you find a way to make it about characters, so it's not just, footage of penguins or lions or seals. It's very much in that tradition that won Disney a whole bunch of Oscars. In this case, they follow the supposedly one of the Adélie penguins who make this enormous journey to reach their nesting grounds. The males are all competing for space and rocks to make nests out of. The females arrive. They pair off. They have to raise the chicks in, weather that can turn bitterly cold and kill them at any moment with squaw gulls and leopard seals that are waiting to dine on them. It's entertaining. I think it's a little bit too cute in places. And I wish they had settled on a soundtrack for it, as one minute you've got this kind of bubblegum pop Then you've got sort of pseudo John Adams low strings when the leopard seal is around. Then you've got people whistling. Then you're back to another song. And it's distracting. The scenery is gorgeous. It's fun to watch the penguins as they waddle along. And yes, they do trip and fall and slide. Who doesn't think penguins are cute? So if you've got small children, this is a good film to take them to. And if you go during the first week, some of the money is earmarked for a wildlife fund that helps to protect penguins and serve other ecological causes.
In the scheme of documentaries about penguins, it feels like we've been there, done that?
Not nearly so dramatic as March of the Penguins. And, of course, it doesn't have Morgan Freeman intoning the narration.
You don't have the voice of God. You have Ed Helms. Okay, yeah, so you're stepping down a little bit.
Quite a number of steps. But, I mean, he does an okay job. It's just that, again, it gets a little too cute in places. You know, it's easy to make jokes about penguins regurgitating to feed their chicks. And, all right, that's kind of an obvious laugh.
Penguins is co-directed by Alistair Fothergill and Jeff Wilson. It features narration by Ed Helms. It's rated G, and you can see it in select theaters, so check your local listings. Now we're going to talk about Long Day's Journey into Night. It's the Chinese-French drama from writer-director Gan Bi. Justin, Claudia, who wants to start?
I will start with this one. This has nothing to do with Eugene O'Neill. The actual Chinese title translates to Last Evenings on Earth, which is a reference to a short story collection by Roberto Bolaño. This is the most magical movie I think I've seen this year. And
wow.
I say magic because I don't want to kind of not to bury the lead. Halfway through this movie, this is a bifurcated narrative. There is an hour-long sequence that is being shown in 3D, and you should at the Landmark, actually, and you should see it in 3D at all costs if you can. It is a nearly hour-long tracking or traveling shot done in one take and done the analog way with no digital truly one of the most magical things I've seen in a movie theater. And the story around it is pretty magical, too. It is about a man who returns to his hometown, Kaili City, in China's Guizhou province, which is also director Bi Gan's hometown. And his father has died, and he has come back and is sifting through his memories. He is haunted by the memory of the woman he loved and who has long since disappeared, haunted by the memory of a childhood friend who died at the hands of a gangster. The plot is almost incomprehensible because there's a layering of memories and flashbacks and dreams. This is the dreamiest movie in a while. It's very much in the key of Wong Kar-wai, with just fabulous colors and exquisite visual design and a lush mood of regret. Arty, I think, is the word. I don't like that word, but it's kind of no escaping it with this one. But it's also David Lynch. It's also borrows from the great Thai filmmaker Apichatpong Weerasethakul. It's also Andrei Tarkovsky. Bi Gan is a 28-year-old Chinese filmmaker, a wunderkind, who is very show-offy, in his technique. I was completely held rapt by this movie. It casts a spell. It is technical genius. It is pure poetry.
And when you're in the middle of a tracking shot that is that long, at what point do you start to notice that they haven't made a cut? Because sometimes some people don't notice, and sometimes you say, wait, I don't think I've seen a cut for the last minute. And then you look at your watch, and it's an hour later.
It's true. That shot mimics a dream state. And there are times when you can tell probably, okay, yeah, they're distracting you a little bit over here while they're setting up the scene somewhere else. And there's one part where they're playing table tennis and they're playing billiards, but it's like, wait, it kind of – the success of the scene depends on a certain outcome with the game. So there are little tricks like that where you're like, oh, the suspense. But most of the time, it's just this drift. It's a wonderfully drifty movie that you get lost in.
You're so caught up in it. Yeah, absolutely. I don't know what more I can add to that, but it's so evocative. It's so impressionistic. It's disorienting, and it's very languidly paced, but it is hypnotically watchable. It's probably the most oblique and mysterious movie I've ever seen. My advice is to sort of see it and don't worry about following the plot, and just let the sort of sense of wonderment and confusion, dreamlike confusion, wash over you and succumb. It is I was one of those that did not really realize how long that cutless scene was because I was so caught up in it. It plays with time in a way that we haven't seen before. It kind of follows, the closest thing I could think of is like the logic of dreams, where they make perfect sense when you're dreaming and then you wake up and they, of course, don't. In the cold light of morning, they sort of evaporate. Yeah. And I like the humidity of it. Like he goes to this tropical part of China and there's water everywhere and it feels so redolent of symbolism. I have to say, I kind of want to see it again to maybe understand it more. Maybe I never will, but I still appreciated it.
And there's another film that we should mention, Birdman, which relied largely on long takes without cuts. Does it feel as immersive as that film was?
Well, this movie is actually good, so you know. But no, yes. I can't a little bit. No. I don't hate Birdman. It's interesting because Birdman did that all through lots of digital trickery and editing,
and you
and
felt
effects.
The trickery. No, you felt conscious.
It. Yeah.
It goes there. Long Day's Journey into Night is the Chinese-French film directed by Bi Gan. It's unrated. You can see it at the Lemley's Playhouse in Pasadena and the Landmark Theater in West L.A. Coming up, we're going to review Worlds of Ursula Le Guin. It's a documentary about the legendary author. We'll also hear about the documentary Hail Satan, which takes a look at members of a satanic temple and is really about religious freedom. We'll be back with more Film Week in just a minute. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm John Horn, sitting in today for Larry Mantle. We're joined by critics Justin Chang, Claudia Puig, and Charles Solomon. Next up, Worlds of Ursula K. Le Guin. It's from first-time writer-director Arwen Curry. The film features interviews with and archive footage of the acclaimed fiction writer. Charles, I know she was a good friend of yours. Tell us about the film and about your relationship.
Well, I apologize in advance if my voice cracks, because I still miss Ursula very much. This is a very warm, very respectful, and very accurate portrait of this writer. She worked with the filmmaker up until the last part of her life, and much of the footage is assembled from events that took place years apart. She was a woman of iron convictions, and she believed that fantasy and science fiction should not be lumped off at the edge of respectability as genre, and she saw no reason for women to be reduced to pawns, either as writers or as characters in this kind of literature, and she basically revolutionized that kind of writing, bringing it more into the mainstream, introducing feminist elements, and you see both her humor and those iron convictions, including her speech at when she received the National Book Award and took on Amazon, and she said that, books are not commodities. Very typical of her way of thinking. It's a lovely portrait, and it made me cry because it reminded me how much I miss her.
In addition to people wanting to see the movie, if they're interested in her work, what books would you recommend they read?
Oh, gee, she wrote so many. Earthsea was my introduction to her work, when it was for many, and there are now, I think there are altogether six books in that series. Lathe of Heaven, even the book she wrote on writings, was Steering the Craft, a very valuable book for aspiring writers or pro writers who just want a little tutoring. She wrote children's books. I miss her emails more than anything, frankly.
And you talked about your cat with her, I remember.
Oh, yes. Yeah, she loved cats, and we would, I used to mail her catnip from our garden, and I'd get back little drawings of her cat saying, "What was in that package?"
Worlds of Ursula K. Le Guin is a documentary. It's written and directed by Arwen Curry. It's unrated, and you can see it at Lemley's Glendale this weekend and at Lemley's Playhouse, Royal Town Center, and Claremont starting on Monday. Next, the documentary Hail Satan, with a question mark. It's from director Penny Lane. It features interviews with members of the Satanic Temple as they organize a series of public actions designed to advocate for religious freedom. Claudia, why don't you get us started?
Well, the question mark at the end of the title is key. This is a very witty, smart, eye-opening, and entertaining documentary. The Satanic Temple is not really about Lucifer, and it's not really even about shock, as you think when you hear the word Satan anywhere. It's about their provocative stunts that really were intended to shed light on the separation between church and state. This group inserts themselves into almost any situation in which the imposition of Christianity in government or public schools is put forth. So their first effort was in 2013 when Oklahoma wanted to put a statue of the Ten Commandments on the lawn on the state capitol. And they countered it by insisting they put a statue of Baphomet, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, a winged goat man that symbolizes something devilish that I don't know anything about. But Penny Lane does a really good job, I think, of making this very it's weird to say light when you're talking about Satan in any way, but it's not about Satan, and it's very entertaining. It's really about religious plurality, and it's, you know, the seven tenets of the Satanic Temple are: you should strive to act with compassion, and your belief should conform to scientific knowledge. And I came home and I told my husband, I think I'm a Satanist.
Well, because we should make clear that in this film, people are not being burned alive at the stake. No. The members of the Satanic Temple are actually going into classrooms and doing civic work. And I saw this film at the Sundance Film Festival. It is really about you cannot, as a government, federal, state, local, favor one religion over another. Yeah. And if you're going to put up something that favors Christianity by law, you have to put up something that favors Satan.
I would also point out Claudia did not sacrifice her husband on that altar.
Not yet.
I have to say, watching this as a Christian, I appreciate the epic troll of releasing this movie on Good Friday.
Yes.
Love that. As a Christian who believes quite strongly in the separation of church and state, I really enjoyed this movie. I was never affronted by it. When they read the seven tenets of the Satanic Temple, it is hard, I think, for a reasonable person to argue with any of them.
Yeah.
They emphasize compassion and empathy, fighting for justice, submitting to science and reason, striving for reconciliation. These should be tenets of Christianity and other religions as well. And so it's interesting, though, they avail themselves of the iconography of Satan in order to make a politically combative statement.
It's a provocateur's performance artist.
It's secular humanism taken to a loopy horror comic extreme.
Exactly.
Basically.
We should also talk about the person at the center of the film, Lucien Greaves,
who is not
his real name,
yes,
and apparently a pseudonym
for another pseudonym. Yes.
But he's also a very interesting character in the way he presents himself and the arguments that he finds himself making. And he is very reluctant in this battle, but he feels that he is compelled to represent, I think, all religions, not just Satanic Temple.
Yeah, he's very thoughtful, and he is reluctant to thrust himself as forward as the face of the movement, although he eventually comes to realize that this is his life's work, and he cares about it too much to let anyone else do it for him. I think one of the most revealing things in this movie happens is when a woman who runs a local chapter of the temple becomes...
In Detroit,
she actually does start staging these elaborate rituals involving nudity and whatnot, and she goes a little, and she actually, I think, gets excommunicated. Basically,
but she espouses violence, and they do not espouse violence.
She espouses violence,
yeah, yeah.
And it becomes this very funny and poignant comment on the idea that even Satanists have to deal with growing pains and factionalism and bureaucratic issues.
And there's a
speech. Not really.
There's a speech at the beginning of the film where Lucien Greaves is speaking, and some heckler says, "I hope you go to hell," and he thinks, "I certainly hope so."
I love their black robes, and they wear these like silly Halloween horns on their heads, and it's very low tech in that respect.
The documentary is called "Hail Satan" with a question mark, not an exclamation point. It's directed by Penny Lane. It's rated R. You can see it at the ArcLight Hollywood and the Landmark Theater in West LA. Now we're going to continue with Her Smell. It's a drama starring Elizabeth Moss, Cara Delevingne, and Amber Heard. Alex Ross Perry wrote and directed the film. It's about a self-destructive punk rocker. That seems redundant. Struggling with sobriety while trying to recapture the creativity that once shot her band to success.
That also sounds redundant.
Yeah, I know. Okay. Claudia, you want to get us going?
I think I'm less high on this than Justin, so we'll start with the negative,
okay.
I guess. I think there is very little that Elizabeth Moss cannot do. I will start with that. I think that, whether she's playing the amazing character in Handmaid's Tale, or in The Square, she had a tiny little part, but it was key. Of course, Peggy and Mad Men, and then this very underappreciated film, The One I Love, which she was really great. She's wonderful in this role. And we've seen this kind of Courtney Love-esque character. We've seen it as a man a lot. We've seen it as Kurt Cobain. And we just haven't seen it as a woman. So I think that's really interesting. Yeah, yeah. Right. We've seen it a million times. I mean, you can name them. It's a genre unto itself. there's a claustrophobic feeling to this. There's kind of an airless quality to feeling to it, almost suffocating, but it's always compelling. I did find it always so watchable. There's a, also the hectic pandemonium of sort of surrounds her.
I'm glad you found it compelling. I certainly did, too. This is a movie that will summon kind of your fight or flight instincts because it is Alex Ross Perry who I say this as a compliment because the word abrasive is usually used as an insult, but I mean it absolutely as a compliment. He revels in exploring the darkest aspects kind of the human condition, I would say. And Elizabeth Moss is right there alongside him. And this is their third collaboration after Listen Up, Philip and Queen of Earth, where she was also brilliant. This is, I think, one of the great performances of the year. She is just lacerating, furious to watch, furiously eloquent, too. What's interesting is she's an interesting character. So even as she's falling apart, the language in this movie is, her diction is like, I can't even describe it.
You know,
she's alliteration.
Bothered me a little bit. I felt like that felt very.
It might pull you out.
Yes,
it can
it
pull
felt too
you
written,
out. It is
and they
very
used the
written.
Word ignominious. I
it
mean,
is.
She, I'm not sure grunge rockers would do that.
No, it's not. And I think there is, but there's an interesting tension. I think between the intense realism that he's creating and there's a poetic element
yes.
too.
It's stagey.
There is a level of pretension to it. Alex Ross Perry has said that he is, you know, inspired by Shakespeare and Guns N' Roses, and the movie is a five-act. You know,
I got Shakespearean feeling to it, especially the part during the in the recording studio. I thought there was all kinds of
the three witches,
who are
played by Cara Delevingne is one of them. These three kind of up-and-coming punk sprites who she woos in, and because her bandmates can't stand her anymore, and they've all left. So this is a movie where she is basically treating everyone on screen terribly for more than 2 hours, almost 2 hours, but there is a measure of redemption too, and the entire cast is so good. Virginia Madsen plays her mother, who is basically like forever apologizing for having brought this monster into the world. Dan Stevens as her ex-boyfriend. I think top to bottom, this is a superbly written and directed film.
And the cinematography I thought was amazing too. Sort of the way it swirls around and her kind of unsteadiness, you pick that up, and then the close-ups of her smudged face. And I think the abrasive character though is something that people will find more abrasive because it's a woman. There's a little bit of sexism, maybe in the way people will view it.
Next up is Fast Color. It's a sci-fi drama starring Gugu Mbatha-Raw, Lorraine Toussaint. Julia Hart directed the film and is also a co-screenwriter along with Jordan Horowitz. Justin, why don't you get us going on this one?
Yeah, I think this is a terrific movie that juggles several different genres with enormous skill and economy. It's a multi-generational family drama. It's a kind of indie superhero origin story set in a dystopian future. There's a horrible drought. Water is rationed very carefully. Gugu Mbatha-Raw plays Ruth, a woman who we find out is a recovering addict, and she's constantly on the run. She suffers these seizures that have the power to trigger earthquakes. And eventually she makes her way back to the home that she left years ago, where her mother, played by the wonderful Lorraine Toussaint, is caring for Ruth's young daughter. And we learn that these women have this telekinetic power, this ability to bend and shape matter with their minds, which allows for some visual effects which are very skillfully and sparingly deployed. I was really moved by this film. It would not be inaccurate to call it a celebration of mothers and daughters or a celebration of Black womanhood in particular. It's very empowering in that respect, but I don't think it ever gets heavy or sanctimonious about it. You're just watching these women who have all been through a lot and weathered it and who are learning to tap into their extraordinary potential.
I completely agree. Claudia, no. I think there's a lot to like about this. It's a quiet movie, and some of it is very lo-fi in terms of the special effects, but so powerful, beautifully shot. The visuals are gorgeous. The music is really evocative as well, a score by Bob Simonson. Gugu Mbatha-Raw is excellent. Lorraine Toussaint is amazing as her estranged mother. And the young girl, so it's generational about mothers and daughters, and the youngest, who is Gugu Mbatha-Raw's daughter, Saniya Sidney, who we last saw in Fences, I thought was also really good. And the director, Julia Hart, shows a very assured hand, I think.
She's terrific.
She's fantastic. These are three strong women, and the way, you know, the allegory and mystery is woven in and what it says about motherhood, I thought was really powerful.
Fast Color is the film from director and co-writer Julia Hart. It's rated PG-13. You can see it at the ArcLight in Sherman Oaks and the Cinemark in Crenshaw. I should have said Hursmell, which is directed and written by Alex Ross Perry, is rated R. It's playing at the ArcLight Hollywood. More reviews are coming up on Film Week with critics Justin Chang, Claudia Puig, and Charles Solomon, including the drama Little Woods from first-time director Nia DaCosta and a documentary about the first female film director. We're back in just a few minutes. It's Film Week. Welcome back. I'm John Horn, the host of The Frame. I'm sitting in for Larry Mantle today with critics Claudia Puig, Charles Solomon, and Justin Chang. Our next movie is called Little Woods. It's an Australian-U.S. co-production written and directed by Nia DaCosta, who makes her feature writing and directing debut. Tessa Thompson and Lily James star as estranged sisters who reconnect after their mother dies and have to quickly settle the mortgage on her house or face foreclosure. Claudia, why don't you start us on Little Woods?
I like this film. I thought it was it was a taut and also affecting thriller. It's kind of low key. It's about sisters being pushed to the extremes, and it's in this kind of really interesting little fracking boomtown in North Dakota, which is something we've not seen in the movies too much. The lead character, Tessa Thompson, is I think she's a terrific actress, and she's good in lots of different genres, whether she's in Thor or Dear White People or Creed or Sorry to Bother You. She's just always good. So she's the emotional center of the film, and I think that's what makes it. Her sister is played by Lily James, and it's basically a story about women where men are kind of at the fringes of things, which I also kind of appreciated. And it's the feature debut of what I think is a very talented writer-director, Nia DaCosta. She really manages to capture this sort of bleak setting. I think the landscapes are striking. Yeah. There's kind of a desaturated palette. It reminded me a little bit of like Deborah Granik's work, Winter's Bone, maybe Frozen River a little bit too.
That kind of bleak, very textured, very lived-in portrait of poor middle America.
Exactly.
I mean, this is – and Tessa Thompson's character, she's been busted for smuggling pills across the border from Canada because to take care of her terminally ill mother, who is now gone. And so she and her sister and Lily James's character's son, so her niece, are just – they're all they have pretty much in this world. And Tessa Thompson's character is at the end of her probation. So, of course, she's about to
week.
One more week. And, of course, in a movie like this, she's got to make one last trip across the border due to desperate circumstances because Lily James's character is pregnant again. And so the tension, though, is very real in the film.
Yes,
and
palpable.
I think the performances are really good, and they get you past the occasional contrivance or implausibility of the story.
The film is called Little Woods. It stars Tessa Thompson and Lily James. Nia DaCosta wrote and directed the film. It's rated R, and it's playing at the New Art Theater. Next up, Be Natural, The Untold Story of Elise Guy Blaché. It's a documentary directed by Pamela B. Green, who co-wrote the film with Joan Simon. It tells the story of the first female director. Justin, Charles, who wants to go?
I'll jump in. I think this is a fascinating story, although it's only an interesting account of it. Madame Blaché was not only the first female director, she was one of the first directors of film, period. And her work had largely been forgotten for a variety of reasons. The films themselves were scattered long ago. And the interviews they found with her are fascinating. She's charming, she's articulate, she's witty, and you wish there were more of them. There are too many talking heads saying, never heard of her. There are these very self-conscious graphics of, oh, well, we found a great nephew living here. Here's a line on a map showing where we went to get this material about her. They're also not entirely accurate when they say that she was creating cinema in isolation. In addition to all the innovative work that was being done in the theater at that time in France, there were also pre-filmic animation shows that were exploring some of these techniques, the Théâtre Optique of Émile Reynaud and the very elaborate shadow shows at the Chat Noir Cabaret that were far more sophisticated than anything being done in film then. But she is a fascinating figure. It's wonderful to see her restored. Her film, the clips of her films look intriguing, and I wish they had just found her talking and done that for 2 hours.
Claudia, you liked it a little bit more?
I did. She was an amazing person. She wrote, directed, produced 1,000 films. And her, you know, her body of film is greater than the Lumiere.
It's like Nicolas Cage.
Only they look better.
Only good, no. She was just, and also she was incredibly innovative. She was one of the first to use color and sync sound. She also made a film with an all-black cast, A Fool and His Money. And she's been largely written out of history, which I think is incredibly sad. And I really appreciate that they're trying to, educate all of us. And it starts off as kind of a biography. It has moments where it feels like a detective thriller. It definitely piques your interest about her work. And it also, there's some little side notes. For instance, I never knew that New Jersey was the original home of film before it moved to Hollywood, thanks to Edison.
Yeah, I actually visited Otto Messmer in Fort Lee.
Oh, interesting. You're
the creator of Felix the Cat.
Yeah, it was Fort Lee, New Jersey. Yeah. That was the Hollywood of before Hollywood. And it's, you know, yes, I could have done with a little bit less of the all the filmmakers and people saying, you know, never heard of her. And the only two that did were Ava DuVernay and Gail Ann Hurd. Even Peter Bogdanovich, who said, you know, I wrote books about film history. He'd never heard of her either. But
it's a little bit disingenuous because, you know, how many silent filmmakers apart from the Lumiere brothers and Méliès would they have been able to name?
Yeah.
That said, you know, I agree. There are points when this movie seems to be getting in its own way, but it's got a wonderful subject. It brings it as a piece of scholarship, as an insight into the work of a very important pioneering figure.
It is
absolutely valuable.
Yes.
And what I like about it, especially, is that it captures this fleeting moment of almost innocence near the time of the dawn of cinema, when directing was not automatically assumed to be a man's job, and where women directing a film was no big deal. And it was partly because cinema was this sort of ragtag renegade activity that wasn't taken seriously, wasn't expected to become a business or a lasting art form.
They thought it was a fad, yeah.
And eventually, of course, became industrialized and overrun by men, and Guy Blachet and other women pioneers were pushed out and ran out of history.
And she trained a lot of men.
And she had an influence on Eisenstein. She had an influence on a young Hitchcock. I mean, it's... Yeah, it's worth seeing.
Yeah, I think it's, in many ways it's a revelation.
It is.
The film is called Be Natural. It's the untold story of Elise Guy Blachet. It's directed by Pamela B. Green. It's unrated, and you can see it at Lemley's Monica Film Center. Now, Under the Silver Lake, it's a comedic drama written and directed by David Robert Mitchell. It stars Andrew Garfield, Riley Keough, and Topher Grace. Justin, why don't you start on this one?
I go back and forth on this movie, which is extremely...
Depending on the day, the hour, the minute?
The minute. I liked it this morning and I hate it now. It's extremely self-indulgent and self-consciously weird and undisciplined. But it is I think it's a failure made by someone with a lot of talent, as David Robert Mitchell's previous films, The Myth of the American Sleepover and It Follows, bear out. And here he has made this epic Los Angeles neo-noir that cribs and riffs openly on everything from LA Confidential to Mulholland Drive to Kiss Me Deadly. You know, it stars Andrew Garfield as a slacker sleuth who is basically wasting his life away in this Silver Lake apartment that he's about to be evicted from. Then a young woman, played by Riley Keough, comes into his life and immediately disappears, and he becomes obsessed with finding her, and he becomes convinced that it's part of this vast and nefarious underground conspiracy linked to subliminal mind control messages that are being transmitted to us through our entertainment media. I'm trying to give you a sense of the texture of this movie. Weird things are happening.
Although it's much slower than the way you just
It actually is. That's the thing. There are long, flat, indulgent stretches to it, too,
yes.
Where the movie is trying to get you to be lost in this sort of Twilight Zone of Los Angeles, where Garfield's character is this sort of scruffy millennial riff on Elliot Gould and The Long Goodbye. And he becomes convinced that there are clues to the mysteries of the universe in cereal boxes and video
songs,
game magazines, and also, yes, the lyrics of hit pop songs.
Claudia, do you go back and forth on this one?
No,
as well?
No,
I don't know if
Justin,
I don't know if you're
negative.
Talking yourself in or out of likiness. You stay negative. You're consistent.
I'm nothing if not consistent.
What did you not like?
It felt half-baked to me. I just felt like, you know, yes, I appreciated sort of the LA locations. It was nice being able to say, oh, look, there's, you know, Echo Park or there's whatever. But it just felt really very self-indulgent and just scattershot and half-baked. Garfield is a very likable actor. I think the character was not nearly as likable as he made him be in a way. Maybe it was well-intentioned to try to create all those noir connections. Rear Window is another one. But really, instead of being kind of Rear Window, he's basically just a kind of a sleazy peeping Tom as opposed to Jimmy Stewart. But it just didn't work for me at all.
The film is Under the Silver Lake. It's from writer-director David Robert Mitchell. It stars Andrew Garfield. It's rated R. You can see it at the ArcLight Hollywood. Coming up next, we're going to talk about notable films that got stuck in development hell. Following the release this week of The Man Who Killed Don Quixote, Terry Gilliam's movie, which spent 25 years in the making, might not have been worth it, according to our critics, but we'll be back in just 1 minute. It's Film Week. I'm John Horn, host of The Frame. I am sitting in today for Larry Mantle. Lawsuits, bankruptcy, flash floods, Those are just some of the reasons why movies end up in development hell. It's the film industry's term for some of the most unlucky movie productions. As we mentioned earlier in the hour, today marks the release of one such film, nearly three decades in the making, The Man Who Killed Don Quixote. Director Terry Gilliam first tried to film it in 2000 with Johnny Depp and Jean Rochefort in the lead roles, only to have the production quickly shut down by a series of mishaps. With me to talk about notably troubled film productions are our KPCC critics, president of the LA Film Critics Association, Claudia Puig, Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine, and Justin Chang from the LA Times. So we have three basic categories here: films that were delayed, films that were never made, and films that weren't released. Is there a common denominator of why movies tend to end up in development hell? Justin.
I don't know that there is among those three categories. I mean, I just think it you know, movies are hard to make, and I think we're fortunate when even a mediocre movie is the product of enormous, I think, improbabilities and coming into alignment magically.
Nobody sets out to make a mediocre movie.
So,
though they often achieve it.
They do indeed. I think taking just some of the movies that were never made or even the ones that were held up in their release or released in a drastically altered form, outsized ambition is often a quality. You know, I think of a film like Kenneth Lonergan's Margaret, which is attempting something much more dramatically complex than the usual adult drama, and I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't think ambition in an industry that tries to stifle it is a bad thing. And so thinking about films like Kubrick's Napoleon or Jodorowsky's Dune, hello. What am I thinking?
That's the one that was really stressed.
Yes.
Got my J's mixed up. It's, you know, these are or Orson Welles's Heart of Darkness and
The Other Side of the Wind.
Which
I mean, it feels
finally
like
came out last year.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Though I think the record for time may be Destino. That was the short that Salvador Dali and Disney collaborated on that was started in, I think, 1946 and released in 2003.
Sometimes it seems like the meddling of studios, too. You know, people getting in there and putting too many hands involved, too many people involved, and you know, the mucking up of, you know, in the old days, people would talk about Harvey Scissorhands. But, there's just people... Too many people getting involved and maybe impeding the director's vision. Too many executives impeding the director's vision.
Well, I remember having a conversation with Glenn Close about The Wife, which was a movie that took, I think, 5 years to get made. And she had made a movie called Albert Nobbs that she had produced and starred in. And I think she spent a decade working on that film. And it was an example, to my mind, of a movie that could never get enough traction. It couldn't get financing. It couldn't get a distributor. It was what a lot of people who are behind it thought was a good idea, but it could not attract the right kind of people, which are the people writing checks. And I think that might also be a common denominator for a lot of these films. For whatever reason, the studio, the producer, the production company doesn't see a reason to sign off. And so these movies just kind of on their gopher cage wheel where they're spinning around and never getting anywhere.
Especially if it's kind of more of an intimate drama, the way Albert Nobbs was, the way Margaret was, as opposed to maybe if you say to somebody, oh, Don Quixote, then they'll think, yeah, you know, there could be something to that. Yeah, exactly. But if it's something that's a little offbeat or seems very intimate and requires either a lot of money or a lot of time, yeah, who are you going to get to finance
Or if it's something really new, people told Walt Disney, nobody could sit through an hour and a half of animation. There's no point in making Snow White.
And then there's some movies that I think have been made that maybe shouldn't be seen. I'm thinking of the Jerry Lewis movie, The Day the Clown Cried.
Which hasn't really been seen. But
well, I think some footage leaked out briefly. And then for people who don't know, who would give us a little primer on Jerry Lewis, Holocaust comedy, The Day the Clown Cried?
This was going to be a biopic about a famous European clown who was used to entertain children at Auschwitz before they were killed. Not a movie I'm going to run out and see, but the story that I had heard, and I don't know for sure that it's true, is that he had started making it and didn't realize that the man's widow was still alive and controlled the rights to his story. And she saw some of the footage and said no. And that's been it. But it's not something I can imagine anyone wanting to watch.
On the other hand, I'm just thinking of something like Amazing Grace, which was, you know, a documentary that was...
This is the Aretha Franklin film, which just now came out.
And it's wonderful.
It's absolutely wonderful. And thank goodness that it finally saw the light of day.
One of the reasons that one was it was actually a technical error because Sidney Pollack, who was directing it, they didn't sync the... They didn't have a slate. They were unable to sync the sound to picture. And as a result of that, you had this footage, which was kind of really impossible to put together. And so this painstaking effort, and finally it exists, and happily so.
Yeah.
You know?
No, and obviously there are often legal issues that surround films that for whatever reason, the production company, the distributor, it could have been a Weinstein Company film, the company goes under. And then there are movies, I'm not going to say the title, there's a Rolling Stones documentary from 1972. The last word of the title is Blues. This is a movie that has been surrounded by legal problems. And I think that's a movie, unlike the Jerry Lewis Holocaust comedy, that actually might be interesting. I know some people have seen it. Whatever happens to this film, Blank Blues? Justin, do you think it'll ever come out?
Oh, I don't know. But I know that some people have seen it too. But yeah, no.
And what about the movies that have been in development hell that haven't been made? The filmmakers who tried to make something that actually sounded good on paper and were never able to pull it off. Anything come to mind that you wish had been made that you could have seen?
You go, Charles.
There was... In the late 1930s, Sam Goldwyn and Walt Disney talked about making a biopic of Hans Christian Andersen, where Goldwyn would do the live action and the fairy tales would be animated. And the development art for that was just drop-dead gorgeous, like a scene where he would be pouring tea for Jenny Lind. The camera would move in on the design on the porcelain teapot that would animate and become the director's nightingale. And apparently that got derailed by World War II. And then years later, Goldwyn made that biopic of with Danny Kaye.
And Justin, you mentioned something that Stanley Kubrick wanted to do. What was that?
Oh, yeah. Napoleon, his big biopic of that, you know, that one, which, but, you know, Kubrick being Kubrick, just so bogged down in the minutiae.
He works so fast, too.
I say that with utmost admiration because he's one of the greatest filmmakers. But, yes. You know, so... His insistence on verisimilitude, the movie just never, you know, he was so busy with the research and with the lavish recreation that it never got off the ground. In a completely different direction, I'm kind of sad that we'll never get Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian, the Beetlejuice sequel that Tim Burton first commissioned in 1990 and was revived briefly in 2011 with possibly, apparently, Michael Keaton and Winona Ryder returning. But no, as of this month, I think it has been shelved.
But it's going to be a stage musical.
Okay, so we'll get to see it.
Claudia, well, sometimes they do appear in other forms like that, which
perhaps
is
a more
great.
Hospitable format.
I know my co-host, A. Martinez, is very hopeful that the movie version of Flash gets made. I don't know if it will escape from development hell, but Claudia, do you have a film that you are crossing your fingers for or something that is...
I've heard there was going to be a remake of The Crow, which was a movie I loved way back when. I'd be very... And the latest incarnation supposedly had Jason Momoa as the tragic hero. I think that's sort of interesting. But I feel like almost any Orson Welles movie falls into that category, too. So, you know, sometimes you're talking about ambition, which is something we really admire, but sometimes it's just difficult directors, too. So there's a combination of so many factors.
Or difficult material.
Difficult material, yes.
And Don Quixote. We're back to Don
Quixote.
Yes,
we are
right.
Back to Don Quixote. is it for Film Week. I'm John Horn. I'm sitting in today for Larry Mantle. I want to thank our KPCC film critics, Justin Chang, film critic for the LA Times, Claudia Puig, president of the LA Film Critics Association, and our animation guru, Charles Solomon, who writes for the LA Times, Animation Scoop, and Animation Magazine. Everybody, go out and see some of these movies, maybe avoid some of the others. Have a great weekend.